you know, you can't fault college coaches because every college coach wants competition. You know, I want three or four talented players competing for the starting job at catcher. But the problem is that, you know, there's one catching position and one backup catching position.
Let's start Hot Sheet here on the Baseball America YouTube channel, or if you're listening to us on the podcast later on, thanks. Leave a little rating and review. Scotty Braun and Baseball America's JJ Cooper and Jeff Ponce with us. So before we get into some serious stuff, I'm going to throw a curveball at you. So JJ, at the end of foul territory today, AJ said he wanted you to know that I'll summarize and obviously butcher it a little bit because I like to make fun of him, that you're wrong about the one catcher situation, or the one knee catcher situation that's been lit up on Twitter, you know, and getting all kinds of opinions as it always does. I sit down with catchers every day on the show. So how have those responses been about the change in how catchers set up these days?
So, okay. This is an obsession of mine, I'll admit. The big thing I would say about this is that two things. One, when I started looking at this, I had no idea whether one knee catching was horrible for blocking, horrible for throwing. We kind of knew that it was good for framing. That's why teams were doing it. And I just got to be honest, I can't find any evidence. I keep looking, and I can't find any evidence that it's hurting blocking. Wild pitches and pass balls are down 25% basically from where they were in 2018. Now, I don't want to say that that's because of one knee catching in any way, shape, or form. PitchCom coming in has really probably been very important for that. You know, PitchCom means there's a lot less crossing up. But I can't find any evidence, like, if wild pitches and pass balls are down at the lowest levels we've seen since 1982, it's hard for me to say that one knee catching is causing problems when it comes to blocking, when it comes to that. We're not seeing that catchers who throw from a one knee stance have more trouble throwing out guys, and look, their pop times are the same as guys who are throwing from a conventional setup. And then we know it's better for framing, especially low pitches. You see that with a very few exceptions, catchers from a one knee stance have a better rate of getting those borderline pitches turned into strikes, called strikes rather than balls. All of that ties in together. The best answer I have for this is when I talk to teams about this, every team's gone to this. And the best way I can put it is it would be that all 30 MLB teams have individually made a decision, and no one's been a holdout and said, no, this is the better way to go. Because at this point, basically everyone, pretty much every catcher in the major leagues, at least at some points, uses the one knee stance.
Yep, there you go. We'll see as the strike zone judging starts to change over the next few years if that impacts the way the catcher's set up, but we'll have plenty of time to go over it. I think we're still pretty far away from automatic balls and strikes, but maybe a challenge system in the next year or two, but that's a little bit different. So anyway, let's hit first move. Very fitting title for what we're about to talk about here, Jeff, and that is Chandler Simpson and the Rays organization and how damn fast he is. Your thoughts?
Yeah, we should just nickname him the Roadrunner. I think that's probably an appropriate nickname. Kind of how he plays the game. He's pesky, you know, he's underwhelming versus the Wolf, but then you get him on base because he's got such good contact. I mean, this guy rarely ever swings and misses, rarely ever swings and misses in zone. It's like a 95% in zone contact rate. Spreads the ball around. He's not going to hit the ball to the wall ever. But just, you know, getting the ball in play, using that double plus speed, you know, top of the scale run ability. And then once he's on, I'm sure JJ probably has these numbers because other than one knee catching, JJ's other obsession is Chandler Simpson. I feel like he probably made the outline for this week's show. But he's a guy that as soon as he gets on, you know, he's going to get in the scoring position. Right. And one of the few guys that, you know, can probably score on some shallow singles to like right field if the right fielder doesn't have a good arm. So, you know, he can wreak havoc. He's not super strong defensively. We saw a player like this struggle a little bit up in the major leagues in Victor Scott. So he just sort of has to be consistently hitting the ball where they aim. I really think that's the key to his game because he's not somebody even like Scott who you could project for like 6 to 8 home runs. It's probably going to be one, maybe, and it's probably going to be an inside the park home run. It's just poorly played by an outfielder, but he uses that speed. He's got contact. He's just a true throwback kind of a player.
I think you summed it up pretty well there. Like if he hits the ball to the wall, it's almost like a mistake. There are a lot of players you say, oh, if he gets stronger, I think if Chandler Simpson tries to hit the ball harder, tries to hit the ball further, all he's going to do is kind of turn what are currently hits into outs, because he's not a guy who's trying to hit the ball over the head of the outfielder. They're very rarely going to be taking steps back. Now, those are concerns as he goes up the ladder, because obviously you just kind of compress that outfield. You move him in, but he is a guy who he can hit a ball. He can top a ball to the third baseman, to the shortstop, turn that into a hit. And I think what he's doing this year is pretty remarkable. If he does win the batting crown this year, he would be the only player we can find. We've got records that go back for the minors back to 1980, and we can't find an example of a player who won a minor league batting crown and a NCAA batting championship, which Chandler Simpson was your D1 batting champ a couple of years ago at Georgia Tech. He's leading the minors this year. Now, I should say, we do have an example, though. Buster Posey led D1 and led the majors. Jose Altuve led the minors and then led the majors. So there are examples of that. But the other thing that's also notable here is we haven't had anyone steal 100 bases in the minor leagues since Billy Hamilton, who blew away the record by stealing 155 a little over a decade ago now. And we haven't had anyone since then get to 100. Chandler Simpson came close last year. He's very much on pace to top that this year. If he gets to the century mark, I know that the rules have been liberalized, but that would also be pretty special. And he would also become, you don't see guys, Billy Hamilton was the last guy to lead the minors in steals 2 years in a row. I don't know if the Rays are going to make the playoffs, but if they did, we talked about this with Chandler Simpson at the prospect pad at All-Star Week. He's made sure that he's ready. He's confident that he's ready to help them if they needed kind of a pinch runner type in October. Now the question is could the Rays get there to kind of have that decision to make?
You can still look for those interviews. Obviously, everything we do is on demand on YouTube. So just type in Chandler Simpson prospect pad. You'll find him on the Baseball America YouTube channel here. We also spoke with Marcelo Meyer, Spencer Jones, Trey Morgan, and others. So lastly here, Jeff, do you think that it could translate to 100 stolen bases one day in the big leagues? Everyone likes the nice, shiny, round numbers and the renaissance of the stolen base thanks to the rule changes. We've seen what someone like Ellie De La Cruz has done this year. Do you think if Chandler Simpson can get on base enough, he could put together 100 plus stolen bags?
I mean, and like with these rules, and I think his ability to get on base, I think it's possible, but I think it's like a 10% chance. It's just such a high number. He'd have to get on base that much. I think the defensive questions in left field, though he could get better, are still pretty prevalent. He's not a very good outfielder. It would just be tough for a guy like this to get 600 plate appearances, right? I think that's the biggest question mark, because we saw how much like Victor Scott struggled, and he's obviously back in the major leagues now. He was a guy that, you know, had 90 plus steals in the minors last year. I think has more power, has a similar profile in terms of on-base ability and contact. I don't know. I think it's so hard to project 100 steals. You know, it's like outside of Ricky Henderson in his heyday, or Vince Coleman, Willie McGee, like those type of guys. But I don't see it happening. I think like 60 or 70 stolen bases is just such an absurd number that's probably the highest you can project. And that's even with full-time playing time. So I don't know. I'm not going to say 100. I think it's very low.
You're being a realist, which is important. You know, we can dare to dream, but we need you to give us that expert analysis, which is fair. So how about this one? Question from Army Chow Main. Does the AA hitting environment hurt, help, or do nothing for Simpson in your mind, JJ?
I would say that Simpson's one of the least park-affected players that I could ever envision. And I would say that because, you know, usually park effects are kind of dependent on where the walls are, how the ball carries in the air. And that's not Simpson's game. I would say if you wanted to develop a park, and I don't have the hardness of the home plate area, the dirt in front of home plate, comparing that in Montgomery to say what it is in the Eastern League, you know, what it is in the Southern League. It is a little more humid there. So maybe it's a little moister, you know, a little softer, but there's not a whole lot of that that's going to affect Simpson's game, because, again, he's not ever hitting the ball to the wall. To just follow on what Jeff said, I think that I think that Chandler Simpson's a much better hitter than Billy Hamilton was. Billy Hamilton would have been the last guy who could say, could he get to 100 steals? You know, the thing that's working against Hamilton was he just didn't hit enough. The thing that's going to be the question for Simpson is, Hamilton was an exceptional defender in the outfield. Simpson's not there yet. If Simpson can end up being a really plus defender in the outfield, then he's going to get that regular playing time to maybe have a shot. But he's still got some work to do. He was an infielder all the way through his college days, second baseman most of that career. So he's still learning the outfield. He's going to have to do that more. He's going to have to do that better if he's going to have that chance to be an everyday regular for the Rays or someone else.
Okay, let's hit the pitching side now on First Move. And Brewers reliever Craig Yoho is now in Triple A with the ridiculous changeup and the big strikeout numbers, Jeff. So we're wondering if this is going to appear in the major leagues, perhaps in a playoff, not even race, because the Brewers are running away with the division, but in playoff games for Milwaukee in October.
Yeah, I think if the performance is good enough in Triple A, maybe over the course of this week or next, the September call-ups are looming. Service time, innings and at-bats count, but the actual days on the active roster do not count towards service time. So a guy like this could see, you know, 3 to 4, you know, outings, an inning or so out of the pen, you know, as a reliever. He's a little bit older. It's kind of an interesting story. You know, he's 25. We'll be 25 this offseason, 24 right now. Initially was at Houston, redshirted for a couple of years because of injury. Missed another 2 seasons after transferring to Indiana. So missed effectively the first 4 seasons of his college career. Then came out in 2023 and was sort of an early stuff popper in terms of a guy coming out of bullpens. We were like, wow, like, there's a guy here with, you know, an absolutely ridiculous changeup and an interesting sinker and, you know, a curveball with a ton of movement, a ton of sweep and some depth as well. And, you know, has ended up with the Brewers, who do a great job of just, I think, developing players kind of outside of the first 2 rounds of the draft. Sometimes they're college relievers, they turn into starters. Sometimes it's just really interesting pitch metric guys like this. And Yoho's changeup is super interesting. I know, you know, Ellie Duan Porat, who does our StatCast standouts on Monday, kind of called it out, talked about some of, you know, the actual, you know, spin axis in terms of like what hitters are seeing versus how the ball, you know, comes out on a trackman and how there's some unique qualities there. But it's a tilt and a spin axis in terms of how the ball spins that's really, really unique. And just in terms of raw numbers, it's a lot like Devin Williams, where it's a changeup that gets spun on average 23 to 2400 RPMs. Changeups typically fall below 2000 as you start to get to splitters. You're talking about maybe triple digit 900, 800 RPM change movement. So it's just a different type of spin on this pitch versus your typical changeup where you're killing spin. He actually spins this a little bit. So it's a bit like a screwball, a bit like that Devin Williams airbender. Gets negative IVB, so that means it has some drop in terms of, you know, how it moves to the plate. With a ton of arm side run, it kind of mirrors the arm side run in the two-seamer. So it tunnels really well off of that pitch. And there's a great vertical separation from his fastball to his changeup. And the same thing with about a 12 to 13 mile per hour difference in velocity from the changeup to the fastball as well. So, you know, when we talk about changeups, a lot of it is sort of how you sell it. You know, how you throw the changeup. This is a changeup that, because it has such a unique movement pattern, and it's almost throw like a reverse, you know, an arm side moving breaking ball is almost kind of the best, like, dumbed down way to describe it. It's so unique, and it creates all of these other metric traits that, when we look back at good changeups and what makes them effective, it's that separation vertically, that separation in terms of velocity. And also, you know, being able to sort of throw it from a similar release point and height as that fastball. So it's just a really split second guess that a hitter has to make on this pitch. And that's one of the reasons it has, you know, I think just under a 50% whiff rate and AAA throughout the entirety of the minor league season. That pitch actually has a 55% whiff rate overall. And a 27, 28% swinging strike rate. So it's pretty just ridiculous numbers in terms of the metrics, but also in terms of what the performance and what the hitters are telling you, as old scouts would say.
Jeff covered it pretty well there. The only thing I would also say here, when you talk about the possibility of him coming up, as Jeff said, it's 47% strikeout rate of all the batters he's faced this year, which is the best in the minors. It's kind of absurd. But the uniqueness of it, like, he's a guy who, if you told me they came up right at the end of the year, and ideally you're not going to, if you're facing the Brewers in the playoffs, you're not going to see him until he comes into a game. You're going to have a really tough at bats that first. I know that they got tragic, you know, they got the machines now that can replicate it and all, but you're going to have a little bit of a surprise factor the first time you see him. And so that's kind of an advantage. That's a benefit that the Brewers might have if they do decide to call him up.
Jeff, appreciate the time. As always, good to see you. And here's Carlos with a finishing comment. If you like changeups like that, keep an eye on Sean Mattson, Cleveland's ninth rounder from the 2024 draft. There you go, another team that's been just pumping out pitching prospects and developing them at a high rate. And you can see the results this year for Cleveland leading the American League Central for now.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform of over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging. You can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. I think we're going to have an opening coming open. When it comes open, I'm going to use Indeed. Why? Because Indeed makes my job easy. When I'm hiring, it puts it all in one place. It organizes it. It does the thinking for me to where I can just connect with quality candidates and do the process that we need to do to hire. That's what Indeed does. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to improve any dog's health: their food. What she's discovered is that the way that many dog foods are made can actually create toxins that can be wrecking your dog's health. And this is true for even many premium brands. Fortunately, she's found that just by adding a few special superfoods to her dog's food, she saw huge transformations in their health. She's made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone could do the same thing to see incredible changes to their dog's health. I've got two dogs, and I want them to be with me for a very long time. There's a lot of good stuff here that made me think about how most dog foods are made, what to avoid for my dogs, and superfoods that are great for them. If you want to keep your dog healthy and happy, go to badlandsfood.com/baseball and watch Catherine's video right now. Again, that's BadlandsFood.com/baseball.
Now joining us is Jeff's co-host on the 90th Percentile podcast. So let's go back to school. It is Matt Pajak joining us right now. So we got a little roundtable action with the 90th Percentile podcast. First off, just encourage everyone to go check that out. Matt, how you doing? And you having a good time with Jeff going over that pod every week?
Oh, having a great time. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. All right, let's get right to business. And by business, I mean college business. So we are going over what's been going down in the college world as far as scholarships and how things are changing. And I'll start this way, JJ, you can kick off the conversation, because I thought what stood out to me, like, even if you're on our production call in the morning, we're going over topics that we want to discuss, and you hear JJ say, this is the worst time ever to be a senior high school baseball player. You're like, huh, what? Okay, explain, because this even applies to parents and young kids out there who are trying to make it to the next level.
Yeah, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it, you know, I think Matt's gotten the same thing. But I was talking to a Power Four recruiting coordinator, and basically made the points like, I would hate to be a high school senior right now, because everyone's had 40 roster spots. Now we're going to 34. Now, we are going also from 11.7 scholarships to the possibility of 34 scholarships, but most schools don't have any idea yet how many scholarships they're going to offer. So what's happening is players who had commitments, who were locked up at schools but haven't signed letters of intent yet, are being told, hey, we're sorry, we don't have the room for you. And it's kind of like a game of musical chairs where the music stopped way earlier than everyone expected. So there are players, and Matt, you know this probably better than I do, but there are players who are trying to figure out where they're going to go now, who thought that they were going, you know, to their dream school, and now are kind of being told, I like how you put it on the podcast, like maybe a cinder block school's a better, you know, a better opportunity right now. How do you see it? Kind of like if you were... am I right in saying that this is probably the most brutal time to be a seniors just starting their final year of high school?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I feel like I've been hearing that for the past 2 or 3 years, ever since we've kind of gotten into this transfer portal age and the extra year of eligibility was granted to, you know, the COVID seniors. But it does continue to get worse for the high school player, because, you know, and this is another thing that I've heard often in the past 2 years, is that the transfer portal is bailing out poor high school recruiting. So where you used to recruit a high school player, and if they didn't pan out, you were kind of stuck with them. Well, now you can just dump them after a year and you can go get a guy who's hitting 350 at a mid-major to immediately plug in, and he's a proven commodity. So it kind of goes back to the Jay Johnson comments about, you know, you're not really building a program anymore. You're building a team year over year. And the transfer portal kind of allows that. Now, in terms of the very real chance that we're heading towards 34 potential scholarships for the higher end programs that have the budget to do that, we're also potentially heading towards, you know, a 34 roster cap year round, which I think this is something that a lot of people don't realize, is a lot of these programs, their fall rosters had as many as 50, 60, 70 players on them. Just last fall, I had a buddy who's an assistant farm director for an MLB club, and he took an instruct squad up to Arkansas, and he said they had over 70 players on their fall roster. So if you're capped at 34 as of the start of school in the fall of 2025, that's 35 players that are not trying to make Arkansas's team that are now pushed to a different program. And that's not just happening at Arkansas. So it's going to have a major effect on a lot of players, as, you know, these power four, power five schools aren't going to be rostering 50, 60, 70 players in the fall. So yeah, bad time to be a high school kid.
I think, you know, that's sort of, you guys just touched on it, but it's just been really interesting in terms of, you know, how these teams are going to sort of allocate some of these resources, how many more of these players we're going to see. I know a big name that we brought up that kind of stuck out on the Cape this year that's returning to Vandy is a guy like JD Rogers. Like, how many more of those really talented players that maybe if they ended up at a mid-major would have more opportunities to potentially get drafted, maybe as a junior, but at least as a senior. And now this guy's going to, you know, I think his last year of eligibility, and, you know, has sort of one last shot to potentially get drafted. I think, you know, how many more of those guys do you think we're going to see? Because that's kind of the big question, I think, for a lot of us that follow the prospect side of things, especially guys who are highly touted coming out of high school where it doesn't click right away.
Yeah, and I think it's tough. And in kind of, you know, jumping off that specifically with Vandy, I think if you looked at Vandy in the past, you know, 2 or 3 years, they've done a really good job of kind of staying true to trying to have a program, of staying true to their class and not really bringing in a whole bunch of transfers. And if you followed SEC baseball and national college baseball in the past 2 or 3 years, since the transfer portal has become a major way to build a roster, Vanderbilt hasn't been the powerhouse they were prior to. And I actually heard, you know, from a college coach who was, you know, familiar with the situation, that, you know, Vanderbilt had a very, I don't know if tense is the word, sit down with their players before the summer started. And I think they're going to have to abandon the try to build a program thing and start playing the transfer portal game if they want to continue to be Vanderbilt as we know them, and compete with the Tennessees and the Floridas and the Kentuckys and the Ole Misses and all the other teams in the SEC that are playing the transfer portal game. So I would expect that at some point in the next year or two, you're going to start to see a lot more transfers at Vanderbilt. And I think you're going to start to see, you know, them adapting to what the game has become. So, you know, hat tip of the cap to them for trying to stay true to being a program in a time when most everybody else kind of abandoned it. But I think, you know, winning talks and you got to do what you got to do to win. So, yeah, interesting time.
The other thing that stands out with this, that when you talk about like a school like Vandy, I think that there also is a challenge now. We're not talking about academics a lot in this, but there are schools where when you talk about transfers outside of the grad transfer portal, which grad transfers can get in pretty much anywhere most of the time if you have a, but if you aren't a grad transfer, most of these transfers aren't, it's a little tougher some of these higher academic you know, institutions to get in, which kind of closes off an avenue that a lot of other programs have. But the thing I keep coming back to is to go back to the first thing we were talking about, the challenge of this. Like, we have the challenge of you're seeing a lot of reduction because, again, when I think some may wonder, how did schools have 50, 60 players in fall ball? Well, it was kind of a survival of the fittest. You bring everyone in fall ball, and players know they're coming in a lot of cases fighting for a roster spot. And then at the end of fall ball, some of them transfer to JUCO. Some of them end up sitting out that year and just kind of basically redshirting while waiting to transfer, because you really can't transfer to a four-year, to a D1 mid-year, at least yet. So there are things like that. But the other thing about this is I can't give, I keep hearing from mid-major coaches, and I know Matt's heard the same thing. I don't know that I can beat you on talent, but I know this. My 22-year-olds can beat your 18 and 19-year-olds because they're bigger, they're stronger. And that's the other trend that we keep seeing here. Now, we're going to see the COVID reductions go down. So it used to be that everyone was getting an extra year, and those are kind of disappearing because we're getting further away from the COVID years of college baseball. But Matt, like, how much do you think we're going to see kind of the ever-aging of the college baseball teams because of the fact that there's so much physical maturity that goes on between 18 and 22?
Yeah, and, you know, if you want to go back and listen to the 90th percentile, if you're, you know, listening to this, kind of the reason why I'm on here talking about this, and I broke it down in detail, so I'll try and be as concise as possible. You're going to continue to see aging. You're going to continue to see older teams at the highest level of the sport. And, you know, you can kind of look at an LSU or some of these higher level programs as an example of, look, like, hey, we're going to build our team through the transfer portal as opposed through a freshman class, because a 22-year-old that's a proven commodity is, you know, way safer and trustworthy in the college game than, you know, a kid who's coming straight out of high school. So, and we talked about it earlier today. The 2022 LSU high school recruiting class was the number one class in the 2023 class. You know, was also a top five class. I don't know where it specifically was ranked, but, you know, we talked about Paxton Kling and how he's not there and Brady Neal's not there. There were 8, 9, 10 underclassmen at LSU that had very little playing time that were very talented coming into LSU that hopped in the portal and they left after this past year. And there's, you know, 10 to 12 incoming transfers that are about to compete with their very talented 2024 freshman class that's about to come in. And, you know, you can't fault college coaches because every college coach wants competition. You know, I want three or four talented players competing for the starting job at catcher. But the problem is that, you know, there's one catching position and one backup catching position. And if you don't get one of those two, then the third and the fourth guy are odd man out, and do that at every position. And, you know, that kind of explains why an Arkansas would have, you know, 70 players on campus, or why a Power 5, Power 4 school would have 60, 70 players on campus, is, you know, you've got your talented freshman, you've got your returning player, and you got two JUCO transfers, and they're all competing for the same roster spot. And the coaches probably think that all four of those guys can win that spot, and they're going to get good competition, and then one guy wins the spot, and the other three guys have to figure it out.
It's a good combo. Let's finish with a comment from Carlos Collazo from BA. He said, here's a counter. We've been complaining about the lack of scholarships for forever. Now we finally have more. That's a good thing. I also want the best players in the best conference, but I am not a coach. Any final thoughts for that?
Or, yeah, I mean, it is a good point. Like, we went from 11-7. The comment I just keep hearing from coaches is 11-7 to 34 is like a really big jump. It's kind of a hard one to adjust to. Like, if it was phased, it would maybe be a little better that way. So that's, you know, kind of something that we're kind of watching.
Yeah, I had a college coach in a mid-major program that has a bunch of really good mid-major schools in it make a comment to me that they're currently proposing a budget that would take them from 11.7 to a potential 20 to 25. And they're already starting to kind of, you know, feel out, because there's so much uncertainty, who else in their conference could potentially get to 20 to 25. And they think they've got one other school pegged at 20 to 25. And they feel like if they can get there in terms of how many scholarships and the other school gets to 20, 25, it's going to be them and that other school competing for that conference every year. So that's a very real feeling within the college community is, you know, if you've got the scholarship resources, you're going to be able to put together a better roster. And I guess to counter Carlos's counter, you know, I grew up watching, you know, and being a fan of Long Beach State, Cal State Fullerton, and a lot of mid-major programs. Mid-major programs just aren't going to be able to compete and go to Omaha. We're not going to see, you know, a magical Stony Brook run or things of that nature when, you know, you've got Power Four schools with 34 full scholarships plus NIL on top of that. So money is going to rule. It's going to be really interesting to see how it all plays out. But just like you see kind of in college football, you're probably going to see the same programs year over year in the Final Eight, Final Four, Final Eight, competing for the national championship.
Much more on this with Matt and Jeff on the 90th Percentile podcast. Matt, thanks for joining us. Appreciate the time, dude.
Thank you very much.
All right, so let's finish strong here with a couple fan questions. We will start with Justin, very active in the chat today, asking about George Wilco. JJ, want to take over on that one?
I really like him as a prospect. I really love the power, the athleticism. He's massive. He's like 6'7", 6'8". I think 25, if he ends the year in Birmingham next year, that would be a really good development, because the strikeout rate, the contact rate are things that have to really improve. And I think it's going to be more a little bit slow than hopefully fast for him. So I think it's a little slower than that.
And Jeff, do you want to take Jose DePaula here? A question on him at the finish line. Let's see if we can cue it up. There we go. Showtime LA, fitting with the account for the question. Could Jose DePaula, and JJ, you can comment off of Jeff too, be a top 15 to 20 prospect in 2025? This will be last comment for us.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen in the offseason unless he goes in an absolute tear the last 2 weeks here in the Midwest League. I think he's a top 100 prospect. I think he's a guy that you can see all the ingredients there. I saw him for three of the four games last week out in Lake County. There's some stuff with the load and just the ball flight stuff right now that needs to be cleaned up. I know the Dodgers are definitely going to be all over that, I'm sure, this offseason. But the ingredients are there. He's still 19 years old. He's going to be 19 until, I think, late May next season. So we'll enter the season still as a teenager. There's great underlying power. There's great plate skills. He's a little bit passive right now. But I think just maybe tunneling certain zones, attacking a little bit more, and getting some of the stuff cleaned up with, like, his hands and his load, I think the outcomes, you know, could start to really match the underlying data. And I think at that point, he's a guy that could maybe jump into that top 20. He's really going to have to hit, because he's going to be a corner outfielder. He's a good athlete, but not – he's a pretty raw corner outfielder at this point. You're going to get some adventurous routes out there. But overall, I think all the ingredients are there to be a really interesting player. I think if he's productive, he's probably a more interesting player in terms of rankings for, like, a fantasy list than a real life list. But I do think that he's somebody that, you know, could push into that, like, top 30 area if he puts together a really good season next year, probably starting again at low high A, and then maybe making a jump to Tulsa at some point next summer.
Love the questions all day here on the show. Keep them coming every single week. We're here live 3 o'clock East Coast time on the Baseball America YouTube channel. Subscribe to it and like this video. Please check out the podcast version of this show every week, the 90th Percentile Pod with Jeff and Matt. And we will see everyone on Hot Sheet next week, every week, right here